Good Monday evening to you all, and welcome to FM 98.5 CKWR's presentation entitled The School of Bishop Sheen. On this week's broadcast, Bishop Sheen will give a reflection entitled The 30th Parallel. And now, for those who have been listening along with us for the last 4 years, you may have heard this presentation before, but it's worth hearing again. And it is that talk about the rich and the wealth of the world taking place above the 30th parallel, and of course the poverty that exists below the 30th parallel. One thing I will mention is that Bishop Sheen had a great gift of bringing to the attention of North Americans the plight of the poor. For 17 years, he was the director of the Pontifical Mission Society, and it was his job to make sure that we remembered to help the poor, to help the marginalized. And he brought through the just the gift of television, I'd like to say, that technology that showed pictures that talked about the poor in Africa, Asia, and the Third World. And so he continues to do that through these gentle reminders. And the poor are with us always. So again, he does it in such a beautiful way, bringing to our attention the needs of the poor. And so during the second half of the program, we will continue our catechism series, which are these 50 lessons that Bishop Sheen's been giving us on the faith. And so today's lesson is on the sacraments. And so now I would encourage each and every one of you to sit back and relax and enjoy one of the greatest communicators of our time, the Venerable Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen.
Friends, I'm going to do something very embarrassing to myself, to tell you of something that happened to me some time ago. Maybe some of you haven't heard about it. I was giving an address in Cleveland, and I arrived just about lecture time in the Hotel Cleveland. I did not have time for a bite to eat, so I dressed as I am now, a kind of a holy show. And I told the four members of the committee that I had nothing to eat, and would they be good enough to go down to the dining room with me while I got a glass of milk and some graham crackers. So there was a waitress there taking the orders, someone in the early flirties. She took the orders of the four men, and then she looked at me and she says, "Well, Cock Robin, what will you have?" I don't know how I'm going to tie that up with the 30th parallel. It has nothing to do with it, absolutely nothing. Now I'm getting, this is a serious moment now. I'm going to ask a serious question. Do you believe that our Western civilization is decaying? Some think it is. There was a German writer a few years ago by the name of Spengler who wrote a work called The Decline of the West. It was a very learned study in several volumes in which he showed that various civilizations go through seasons: spring, summer, autumn, winter. And he holds that our Western civilization is already in its winter, in its decline. The very learned Toynbee in his 10 volumes of study of history, a little more optimistic. He makes a study of 21 civilizations, showed that many have decayed from the beginning of the world. And there's danger, he said, in our Western civilization, of a schism of soul, that we may rot from within. Now, I wonder if that is true. I'm going to present to you another point of view tonight, for this has given me much pause and much thought. I'm going to show that our Western Christian civilization is not on the decline. It need not be, certainly. Over 1900 years ago, here we're going back to its origin, there was a gibbet that was unfurled on the crossroads of the cultures of the world. Over the man that was on that gibbet, there was an inscription. And the inscription was in three languages. Well, I see the angel is peckable too. There were three languages: Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. The language of the good. The language of the true. And the language of the beautiful. Love was unfurled on that gibbet like a wounded eagle in the name of three cultures, three cities: Jerusalem, Rome, and Athens. Those three languages, those three cultures, though they bore the inscription of death, were also the language and the cultures of life. For this message of love spread throughout the world, in these languages and through them. Each had something to give. What they gave constituted our Western Christian civilization. What did Jerusalem understood as the Old Testament and then as the New Testament? What did this Hebraic Christian civilization give to the world? It gave to the world the value of a person. No one else ever did that. Why did a person have value? Why, at the very beginning, man was made in the image of God himself. And then furthermore, as the story of the Old Testament unfolded, there was an encounter of a person and a person, of man and God. God and man. So that the person of God defined himself in terms of persons. The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Three great patriots. And when finally all the promises about this encounter were realized, God became man. And then you had him affirming once more a person. He said, what doth it profit a man if he gain the world? Lose his soul. In other words, a person is worth more than the cosmos itself. And on that day, when his hands and feet were dug with steel, he spoke to a thief and addressed him in the second person singular, this day, thou shalt be with me in paradise. He calls his sheep by name, persons, sovereign inalienable worth. This became the contribution of this culture, this city, this background. Rome, what did that give? When love on the cross was born, it was a Roman emperor that sent out an order that everyone in the world was to be enrolled. Everyone in the world. Why? Well, Rome was the master of this whole civilization. There was only one official language. It was Latin. There was only one capital of the world. It was Rome. There was only one emperor. It was Caesar. And so Caesar Augustus, master bookkeeper of the world, seated at his desk at the Tiber, sends out an order to the world. To what? To humanity. And not the humanity that's barbarian, but the humanity that was ecumenical, was one, because it was governed by that which made Rome famous, law. Law, order, justice, equity, these would be the bonds, not force, that would pull men together. Athens, what did that give? That gave science. Why did not the Eastern world have science? Why didn't science take its origins in India or China? Because the religions of the rest of the world were pantheistic. That is to say, they mixed up God in the universe. If God is in a bug, you can't step on a bug. You kill God. In order to have science, you have to be able to study nature as nature. Just can't have nature mixed up with theology. And so the Greek scientist, Thales, for example, was concerned about what are the basic elements of the universe. He found them to be four: air, earth, fire, water. Pythagoras was the great mathematician. Archimedes was interested in mechanics, machinery. But science was possible because nature could be studied without myths. Christian civilization baptized all of these. And through the modern world, and in the course of history, what do you have? And this is a proof now that Western Christian civilization is not dying. You have throughout the world the growth today of democracy. Witness, for example, social justice, racial equality, formation of many nations in Africa, the embarrassment of communistic nations that they are not respecting the value of a person. all of the democratic movements of the world have flown from the value of a person that had its origin and its font at the very beginning of the Hebraic tradition. Why do we have, for example, today an attempt to build peace through the unity of nations, through dialogue, through discussion, through the UN? Why do we have, for example, one world trying to assemble all of the peace-loving peoples together? And simply because this idea of humanity has been baptized, and we're recognizing the fact that men form themselves in society and are governed by law. This is not dying, it's very much alive. And science. They were studying nature, crudely, yes, but what has that science become? That science has become technology. Where is the technology, for example, of the world today? It's here. It's in our Western world. As Alfred North Whitehead of Harvard said, it was only in the Western world that science could ever have developed, thanks to the discipline and order of thought during the Middle Ages. Jasper says the same thing. So that what is the world today drawing on for a future hope of peace? It's drawing on the democracy, on one world, and on technology, and all of these have flown in some way from this great tradition of the three cultures that crucified love on a cross and then finally carried out the message to the world. I do not agree with Spengler. Western civilization is not dying. It's very much alive. Simply because we are a part of it. Angel, will you produce the world for me? Bring in the world, Angel, will you? Bring in the world. Marvelous what this angel does for me. See? See, there's the world. He did it. Now, we must not rest on our laurels in Western Christian civilization. We have a terrible burden thrust upon us. And what is that burden? That burden is the realization that we have a debt to the rest of the world. There's a division in the world today which is unhealthy. I suppose the best way to show this dividing line is to take the 30th parallel. This is it. And that's why we call this the 30th parallel. You run your finger over the 30th parallel, raising it slightly above China. And what do you have? You have the wealth. You have the science. You have the hospitalization. You have the education above the 30th parallel. And for the most part, you have want, hunger, thirst, and indigence below the 30th parallel. Maybe this is why some are saying that Western civilization is on the decline, because they see this neglect. And the neglect falls principally upon us in the United States. For example, we in the United States are 6% of the population of the earth. Only 6. But we have 46% of the world's wealth. That's not fair. That's just like taking $100 and giving $9 to 6 people, and then dividing all of the rest among the rest of the world, the rest of the 100. Why, we throw enough garbage into our garbage pails every week to feed China for 3 days. The Americans spend $150 a year on cigarettes and alcohol. $150 a year. That is $50 more than two-thirds of the world earns in a year. In a year. If all of the hungry people below the 30th parallel began a march and could march day and night and march over waters as well as land and begin encircling this whole globe, how many times would they go around the earth? Twenty-five times. And so I say a tremendous burden has been thrown upon our Western civilization, if it is to survive. And it will survive only on condition that it begins to divide and to give and to share with the other peoples of the world. There are, for example, between 10 and 12 million lepers in the rest of the world. Is not that a responsibility upon us? Is not that a responsibility upon us? The average spending money of every teenager in the United States is $500 a year. That's $450 more than the earning capacity of two-thirds of the world. Maybe that's what Toynbee meant when he said we are beginning to decay from within. I know the mere pittance that I get to distribute here to the rest of the world doesn't help very much. Well, that's my work. But at any rate, I can see the responsibility and the duty of sharing. And that's why this telecast, incidentally, and every other telecast that you ever hear, on which I appear, goes here, goes to the rest of the world. Everything. We have to make ourselves vulnerable to feel the need that there is in the rest of the world. I visited a leper colony in Baluba a couple of years ago. I brought with me 200 little silver crucifixes about that high. I was going to give one to each leper. First leper that came out to meet me had his arm off the elbow. He held up the stump. And around his stump of his left arm was a rosary. And he put out his right hand for the cross. I looked down on the most foul, noisome, fetid mass and trench of corruption I ever saw in my life. And I held that crucifix above it, and then I dropped it. I dropped it. It was gobbled up in the leprosy. And then, all of a sudden, there were 501 lepers in that camp, and I was the worst of all. For here I had taken this symbol of love, the symbol of identification with all suffering humanity. I'd taken the symbol of him who had touched these people, and I refused to identify myself with a man who on the inside was 1,000 times cleaner than I was. And the terrible thought of what I'd done came over me, and then I pressed my hand to his, and so on. Or shall I say, the other 500 lepers in the camp. This is our vulnerability to the world.
Our sincere thanks to the Fulton J. Sheen Company, who has given us permission to share these broadcasts with you today. I invite you to make Bishop Sheen a part of your family audio and video collection. You can call them toll-free at 1-866-357-4336 or visit the official website for purchasing Catholic family videos and DVDs of Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen's recordings from the Catholic television series Life is Worth Living. The web address is www.bishopsheen.com. You will find rare collections of Catholic family video recordings addressing a variety of topics such as morality, Mary the Mother of God, angels, Catholic holy days, and other faith-based subjects. So call toll-free today, 1-866-357-4336. Again, 1-866-357-4336. And on the web, www.bishopsheen.com. And on behalf of Bishop Sheen, God love you. Good Monday evening to you all. You're listening to FM 98.5 CKWR's presentation entitled The School of Sheen. You know, even though that television program was back from the 1960s, it still resonates a very powerful message today. And if you'd like to listen to more of these programs, visit our website, bishopsheentoday.com. Very simple name. We need Bishop Sheen today, and that's why we named it bishopsheentoday.com. And there's over 300 audio reflections, 100 YouTube videos of the different shows in the 50s and the 60s, and pretty well everything. A good resource of where to order books or find titles that Bishop Sheen wrote. And so we encourage you to visit that site. And if you'd like to email me with any of your comments or suggestions, please do so. There is a contact section to that email. And of course, there's that little donate button. If you feel inspired to share a little bit of your good fortune with us to help us to buy airtime and to help with the production cost of this program. And so, again, that's bishopsheentoday.com. Now, we're on to lesson number 26 of this catechism series, and it is a 50-part series. And the faith is not learned overnight. It's not something you can do over a weekend course, it seems. It's a long, arduous process, but we're always learning. We're all lifelong learners. And so I want to share with you now this reflection entitled The Sacraments. And they really are the instruments of grace, all the grace that we receive when we partake of the sacraments. So Bishop Sheen does it best. He is a great teacher, and so I'd ask you to sit back and relax now and enjoy this reflection on the sacraments.
Peace be to you. Because the subject of grace is so very important, it might be well to continue it a bit here, and then to tell you how that grace is communicated to us. Grace divides the world actually into two kinds of humanity, the once born and the twice born. The once born are those who were born only of their parents. The twice born are those who were born of their parents and also born of God. One group of men are what might be called natural. The other, in addition to having nature, also share in a mysterious way in the divine life of God and in his thoughts and in his love. Grace is so very sensitive that it is possible for us to reject it many times, even during the day. Let me therefore tell you two incidents about grace. On one occasion, I went down from Belgium to Paris to preach a sermon in a church of Paris on the first Sunday of February. I stayed in a tiny little hotel near the Opéra Comique, and in a small side room, there was an Englishman playing a piano. I listened to him for a while and then complimented him and invited him to dinner. He said, "I have never eaten with a priest before." And I said, "Well, we are just like anyone else. If you stick me with a pin, I will bleed too." In the course of the dinner, he said, "I have a problem I would like to present to you." "I have never met," he said, "in my life, one good man or one good woman." I thanked him for the compliment, and then he went on to tell me that just a year from this coming 12th of February, over at that table there, indicating a table in the corner, he saw a woman trying to break a lump of sugar into a cup of coffee. He went over to her, broke the lump. She then told him how cruel her husband was, and he said, "Come and live with me." He said, "I'm now tired of her. I get tired of them all after about a year. And I wrapped up all of her clothes this morning, left them with the concierge, and told her to leave. But she left me this note." The note read that if you do not continue living with me, I will commit suicide by throwing myself into the Seine. "Now this is my problem," he continued. "May I allow her to continue living with me to prevent her from committing suicide?" And I said, "No, you may never do evil that good may come from it, but in any case, and what is more important, she will not commit suicide." It got to be late. He said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going up to Montmartre." He said, "I was just beginning to think that you were good. Now you're going up to that hellhole of Paris." Well, I said, "There's something else on the hill of Montmartre besides dives and dens. There is the beautiful Basilica, the Sacred Heart, where there are hundreds of men every night in prayer and in perpetual adoration of our Lord and the Blessed Sacrament. Come with me." We went up together. He said, "How long will you stay?" I said, "I intend to stay all night. But I will leave when you want to go." He stayed all night. And I suppose there were about 800 to 1,000 men spending the night there in prayer. When we left the next morning after I had read Mass, he said, "This is the first time in my life I ever came in contact with goodness." He asked me to stay in Paris for a few days and teach him. I arranged to meet him that night. At the appointed hour, he came into the courtyard with another woman, not the woman involved in the story. And he said, "The three of us will go out to dinner." I said, "No, tonight I want to see you." Then I called him aside and I said, "Now, you received a great grace yesterday. You got the first dim contact with goodness and love and holiness. And tonight you have to make a choice. Either you're going out with this woman, or you're going out with me. Which will it be?" He walked up and down the courtyard for a few minutes, and then came back to me and he said, "Well, Father, I think that I'll go out with her." And that is the end of the story. Now, these impulses of grace that he received could have developed him into a saint. But it was like the story of our Lord looking over Jerusalem. "I would, thou wouldst not." Now let us take another incident. I used to do a great deal of parochial work in St. Patrick's Church, Soho Square, London, England. I opened the church door one cold Epiphany morning in the month of January. The limp figure fell in. It was a young woman, about 23, 24 years of age. And I said, "How did you happen to be here?" And she said, "I didn't know where I was, Father." I said, "Oh, Father." "Yes," she said, "I used to be a Catholic. But not anymore." And I said, "But why are you here? You seem to be a little bit intoxicated. What are you running away from?" She said, "From men, each of whom thinks that I love him. And I didn't know that I was here." I asked her name. When she told me, I pointed to a billboard on the other side of the street. And I said, "Is that your picture over there on that billboard?" "Yes," she said, "I'm the leading lady in that musical comedy." Since she was very cold, I made a cup of coffee for her and told her to come back before matinee. She said, "I will on one condition, that you do not ask me to go to confession." I said, "Very well, I promise you not to ask you to go to confession." She said, "I want you to promise me very faithfully that you will not ask me to go to confession." I said, "I promise you faithfully not to ask you to go to confession." She came back that afternoon before matinee. I said, "We have a beautiful Rembrandt and Van Dyck in this church. Would you like to see them?" As we walked down the middle aisle, I gave her a gentle push into the confessional. I did not ask her to go, but she went to confession. She is now a nun in a convent of perpetual adoration in England. And here are two stories of responses to grace. In both instances, the human will was free. In the one, there was a correspondence. In the other, a rejection. We receive millions of these graces called actual graces. Everyone receives them. You need not be a Christian. Every Muslim and every Buddhist, every communist in the world receives actual grace. But here we're speaking of what is called now an habitual grace, a more permanent grace, that which creates in us a likeness that remains. And that brings up this particular problem. How is this grace communicated to us? How does it get into the soul? Perhaps you've seen signs on roadways. They are often painted on rocks which read, "Jesus saves." Yes, indeed he does. The very practical question is how? We have a span of 20 centuries between the life of our Lord and our days. Yes, he is God. But how does he pour and infuse this divine life and power into our souls? Well, he does it by what are called sacraments. Now, here we define the word sacrament in a very broad way. In Greek, it means mystery. But a sacrament is any material or visible thing that is used as a sign or a channel of spiritual communications. We will go back about as far as we can to explain mysteries. We might say that the Lord made this world with a sense of humor. What do we mean by a sense of humor? We mean he made it sacramentally. We say a person has a sense of humor if he can see through things. We say a person has not a sense of humor if he cannot see through things. We say he's too thick. Now, God made this world with a sense of humor in the sense that we were always to see him through things, like the poets do. We would look out on a mountain and think of the power of God. On the sunset, and think of the beauty of God. On a snowflake, and dwell on the purity of God. Notice that we would not be taking this world as seriously as do the materialists, to whom a mountain's just a mountain. A sunset is just a sunset, and a snowflake is just a snowflake. The serious-minded people of this world write only in prose. But those who have this penetrating glance of perceiving the eternal through time, the divine through the human, have what we call the sacramental outlook on the universe. Now, coming up a little bit closer to our own experience, there are certain signs and events in our daily life which are a kind of natural sacrament. Take, for example, a word. A word has something audible about it, and at the same time, something unseen, invisible. If, for example, I tell a joke, and if it were a very amusing one, you might laugh. But if I told it to a horse would not even give a horse laugh. Why? Because you get the meaning. That's because you have a soul, a reason, and an intellect. The horse lacks that spiritual perceptive power, and hence does not get the meaning. So with a handshake. Handshake is something visible, material, fleshy. But there's also something spiritual about it, namely the communication of greeting and welcome. Now, if I take my right hand and lay it upon my left, as I am doing at this particular second, this is not a handshake. It has the visible aspect about it, most certainly, namely the clasping of hands, but it lacks that invisible element, which is the communication of personal warmth. A kiss is a kind of sacrament. It is something visible and at the same time something invisible, namely the communication of love. This is getting a bit away from the point, but I just cannot resist saying it. Have you noticed how very much our modern architecture is devoid of all decoration? What a contrast to the cathedrals, where there were all material things, even cows and angels, sometimes little devils peering around corners. The ancient architecture was always using material things as signs of something spiritual. But today our architecture is flat, nothing but steel and glass, almost like a cracker box. Why? Well, because our architects have no spiritual message to convey. The material is just the material, nothing else. Hence, no decor, no significance, no meaning, no soul. I wonder if decor and decoration and so forth in architecture has not passed out of the world at the same time politeness has. We certainly are not as polite in this century as we were in another century. And possibly the reason is because we no longer believe that persons have souls. They are just other animals. And hence they are to be treated as means to our ends. But when you believe that in addition to a body there is a soul, then you begin to have great respect and reverence for personality. Now, after that digression on the relationship between architecture and politeness, we come back to the very important point again is how do we ever, ever contact the life of Christ and His grace? The basic idea that connects all that we have said with Him is this. Christ Himself was the great sacrament. Because He was the Word made flesh. He was the God-man. We would have seen a man, but we would have known that He was the Son of God. Therefore, Christ is the supreme sacrament of history. His human nature was the sign of His divinity. We saw God through His body. We see eternity through His time. And the loving God in the form of a man who was like to us in all things save sin. Now our blessed Lord took His human nature to heaven. Once He is glorified in heaven, as we said in speaking of the ascension, He is our mediator, our intercessor, our high priest, who can have compassion for us and on us because He passed through our temptations and our sufferings and our trials. Because He is God as well as man, He is going to pour down upon us from heaven His truth, His power, His grace, His life. And how will He do it? He will not do it through what we might call His bodiness, because that is already glorified in heaven. He will do it through things and also through human natures. He will use certain things in this world as extensions of His glorified body. These things might be water, bread, and oil, and so forth, as channels or vehicles for the communication of His divine life. Now, He Himself instituted these sacraments. But why did He do it? Well, first of all, because His life is so very rich that it has to have various manifestations in life. It is very much like the light of the sun. The sun is so very bright that if we are to understand its inner beauty, we have to shoot that sunlight through a prism. And when we do, it splits up into the seven rays of the spectrum. And so our blessed Lord, having a life that is infinitely rich, shoots this divine life through the prism of the church, and it splits up, not into the seven rays of the spectrum, but into the seven sacraments of the church. And then another reason why He used sacraments is because this material world of ours has to be spiritualized. God not only redeems man, He redeems things. So we lay hold of material things like water and oil and bread and so forth. And we make them serve God. Too often they've been used for purposes that were not divine. We have a body too, as well as a soul. And we get all of our spiritual thoughts, at least the beginning of them, through the senses. And why, therefore, simply because we have a body as well as a soul, should God not use things that appeal to our senses? Some material signs, which would be to us telltales and revelations of this grace that he's pouring into our souls. For example, it would be wonderful if he used water to indicate that our great sin that we inherited from Adam was being washed away. Bread would be a very good sign and symbol of nourishment. Oil strengthens us in the natural order. Might also be a very good sign, too, for strengthening our souls. So as once divinity used humanity, so now divinity uses humanity and things in order that there might be something trans-historical, trans-cosmic, in order that there might be the divine life of Christ pouring into our souls. That is how the Christ in heaven contacts us in this day and age. How many sacraments are there? Seven. Why seven? Because there are seven conditions for leading a physical life, and there ought to be seven conditions for leading a spiritual life. Five of these conditions are individual, and two refer to society. In order to live a physical, natural life, one, I must be born. Two, I must grow to maturity. Three, I must nourish myself. Four, I must heal my wounds. Five, I must drive out traces of disease. Then, as a member of society, one, there must be a propagation of the human species, and two, there must be government. Now, over and above this human life, there is the divine life. And there are seven conditions of leading that divine life. If I am to live the Christ life, I must be born to it. That is the sacrament of baptism. Two, I must grow to maturity and accept the responsibilities of life. That is the sacrament of confirmation. Three, I must nourish myself, sustain this divine life. That is the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist. Four, I must heal the wounds of my soul caused by sin. That is the sacrament of penance or confession. Five, I must drive out all the traces of the disease of sin that are found in my senses. That is the sacrament, the healing of the sick. And as a member of society, there must be a propagation of the kingdom of God, the growth of the mystical body of Christ. That is the sacrament of matrimony. And finally, there must be divine government. There must be holy order. The sacrament, the episcopacy, and the priesthood. Now, the reception of the grace that is in these sacraments is very effective in our soul because it is Christ that confers the grace. The mere fact, for example, that we turn on a faucet, water comes out. Water does not come out because we subjectively believe that water will come forth. And the divine life of Christ is poured into our soul by the mere fact that we receive the sacrament. Of course, we must not put an obstacle in the way of receiving the sacraments, but it is Christ who baptizes. It is Christ who forgives sins. There are ministers, of course, there are bishops and there are priests, but we alone, Christ, our eyes and our hands and our lips, it is He who gives the grace. That, incidentally, is why, even though you received a sacrament from an unworthy priest, it would still be a sacrament, because the sanctification does not depend upon the priest. Because sunlight comes through a dirty window, sunlight is not polluted. A messenger may be very ragged, but he could still bear the message of a king. So you see the church, the mystical body of Christ, takes care of you from the cradle to the grave. It meets you in all of the events and circumstances of life. And your sanctification does not depend upon our preaching. It depends upon Christ Himself. This is the sweet mystery of life, the sacrament.